Hi, my name is Stephen Krein. Welcome to another episode of Startup Health Now, a weekly show dedicated to celebrating the healthcare transformers and changemakers who are reimagining healthcare. On today's episode, we're going to talk to my friend Sundi Bahn, who's a serial healthcare entrepreneur and also a member of Startup Health's inaugural class of healthcare transformers. Sundeep is the CEO of Medivo, a healthcare data analytics company focused on lab data, and he's also the founder of MedSite, a company that was sold to WebMD. On today's episode, we're going to talk to Sundeep about drivers of equity value, most notably how he's built his leadership team, leveraged advisory boards, made sure that he's had adequate capital to execute on his vision, and finally, the value of a trusted peer network. This is going to be a great episode.
It is the duty of leaders to lead, of the creative to create, of the daring to do. The free world expects leadership of us. Its fate and our fate depends upon our leadership. We are industrious, inventive, restless, with the fires that burn within us. Well, I say that nothing is easy, and the best things are the hardest. And all our troubles, all our immense difficulties, now and in the future, can I say, be solved if we have the will, the courage. The future is to those who take it.
Welcome back to Startup Health Now, our weekly show celebrating the healthcare transformers and changemakers reimagining healthcare. For our second episode, I'm very excited to have with me Sundi Bahn, a serial healthcare entrepreneur, currently the CEO of Medivo, the former co-founder and CEO of MedSite, a really interesting entrepreneur who I've known for probably over a decade now. Mm-hmm. We both built companies back in the 90s. Got to know each other as part of YPO, Young Presidents Organization, which is a peer network for entrepreneurs across the globe, and also one of the members of Startup Health's inaugural class and Startup Health Academy. So thank you for joining me, Sundeep.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And, you know, one of the things we've tried to do with Startup Health Now is try to zero in on the healthcare transformers that are doing a lot of the reimagination around the healthcare industry. This is your second startup in the healthcare space. I want to get some context because, you know, most entrepreneurs avoid the difficult industries, and healthcare is one of them, obviously. But you've decided twice now to do a healthcare startup. I want to go back to the very first time you kind of entered the market as the CEO of MedSite. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think back then, back in the late 90s, you know, if I go back to kind of my background, I was pre-med, a lot of doctors in the family. So healthcare was always around. So it's been sort of a theme. So cousins and, you know, brother-in-law, lots of medical discussions at home. So that was a theme. And then I think once you enter a market, you start to see opportunities. And in the beginning, we started with medical education. That was what MedSite was focused on. There was a shift going on in the industry. The big shift was how medical professionals were accessing information, and was the early days of the internet. And we were able to leverage that, and we built a platform in that shift. And that grew very quickly. We grew to about 60% of all US physicians were using our platform. And we ended up selling that company to WebMD. And it's now, you know, part of WebMD Medscape. And so it was a great experience. And then I also got a chance to work at WebMD as part of that. And then took some time off, and it was time to start again. So as we were thinking about what to do next, just opportunities in healthcare just arose again.
So I want to go back for a second, because you jumped over you were supposed to be a doctor and you became an entrepreneur. How, you know, you were pre-med, but before you started or decided to start a company, was the decision to become a doctor or do something else in healthcare? Like, what was it about healthcare that drew you into it?
Yeah, you know, I think if I think back at my life, I was always very interested in entrepreneurialism. Growing up, my grandfather was a big influence. He was an entrepreneur. I grew up in India. And so that was always in the back of my head. So whenever I did look at healthcare, I always looked at it more from a business perspective. But I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to do. So even I went to Penn undergrad, and I was pre-med, studied art history, studied communications, business. And I think for entrepreneurs, you know, we see there are a lot of light bulbs that go off as we look and see opportunities. But it's really about connecting the dots. So I think for me, I worked at a hospital one summer, like after my sophomore year. And that was the first time I really thought about being a doctor and what that would mean. And I realized that it wasn't so much that I wanted to be a doctor. I was interested in healthcare, but I was more interested in the business side of healthcare. So at that point, I decided to shift my focus more on the business side of it.
Excellent. So So you build MedSite, you sell it, you take some time off, do a couple of other entrepreneurial things.
Yes.
And then found a company called Medivo. Well, yeah. What does Medivo do?
So Medivo, you know, the idea of Medivo started... So I've been lucky. I've lived in sort of three countries. I grew up in India, then I've been here in the U.S. Also got a chance to live in Brazil for a little while. So in between MedSite and Medivo. And during that time, I was in touch with my cousin, Jason, who's the co-founder. He's a doctor. And we were talking about, you know, doing something together, something that would have a bigger impact than anything else we had done
and
before.
Jason was in was he involved with MedSite?
He was not directly. He was still in medical school when we started it. So he was involved as an advisor, consultant, and then we knew we wanted to do something together. And we were looking at things from, you know, within healthcare from two different perspectives. He was obviously looking at it from a clinical perspective. So as a doctor, the challenges he had and, you know, practicing and helping a patient at a time, I was looking at it from things that I had done in the past with MedSite and educating doctors and having a bigger impact on healthcare through that. So one thing we agreed on was that whatever we do, it has to have a bigger impact than anything else we had done before. And we started brainstorming around ideas and looked at things that were happening with personalized medicine, looked at what was happening with data, with EHRs growing and just a big push towards digitizing healthcare. So when we started looking at it, we realized that there were only a couple of large data sets that had been aggregated to
the, what year is this, just to context
for everyone? So this is about 4 years ago, 2010.
Okay.
And so we looked at, you know, prescription data was pretty well organized, so data coming out of the pharmacies, claims data, which is basically mostly organized by now. And both are transactional databases, really don't have a lot of clinical relevance. So you can see how many prescriptions were written and what drug and dispensed and things like that. Or you can look at a lot of procedures, what was ordered, but you don't really have a good, you don't have a good insight into what the outcomes are. So we were intrigued by lab data. And, you know, we started talking and he said, well, one of the things...
So intriguing.
Yes. It is, really, if you think about it, right? So we have you ever had a lab test done?
Of course, sure.
So we all have, right? And 7 billion lab tests get done a year. And 70% of the decisions in healthcare are based on lab results. So when we started to look at this, we said, imagine if we could aggregate this data across patients. Like, look at it longitudinally, look at it... You know, today we have about 29 million patients in our what we call lab value exchange. So we look at it across a dozen different conditions. So there are, we can look at millions of patients in some of these broader conditions, and you can look at it longitudinally. So if 70% of the decisions are informed by this data, we just said, imagine the possibilities of what we can do if we can aggregate this and then organize it and analyze it and one day be able to discover things out of it.
So Medivo is a data analytics company?
Yeah, we're a data analytics company focused on lab data today with, you know, with ideas of aggregating other data sets in the future. But today, yes, focused on lab data.
So focus 100% on lab data. So, you know, among the things that we do at Startup Health, there's a theme and thesis around this notion that there's drivers that really create equity value in businesses. And there's kind of a blueprint for building a business. And along those 10 drivers, there's a number of things that I think you've done exceptionally well, among many things.
Okay.
And I want to dig into some of those today. I want to talk about the fact that you built a really great team, not only a team with a lot of experience, but it seems like a very backable, partnerable, coachable, likable team.
Okay.
And you mentioned Jason, so you kind of were talking a little bit about going into business with your cousin back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about your, you know, the initial team that you started with, and then even a little bit more of how it's grown over the last couple of years.
Yeah, no, great. You know, I think, again, as you were talking about before, being a serial entrepreneur, you know, you build on your successes and you learn from your failures. And there are many. And I think one of the things that I realized, MedSide grew very quickly. We went from like a few people to 250 people. And then markets turned. We went down to like 40 people, then grew back up to 150 people. Throughout all this.
You do a whole episode on that.
Absolutely. That's a whole other episode. But when you think, when I thought about it and some of the lessons I learned from that, one of them was that, you know, products change, strategies change, but it's really the best people that you have sitting around the table that can get you to where you want to go. So the focus on people became really key, and I became a student of leadership, and just I you know, love to learn about things, and I think when I really started thinking, and to that, the leadership has grown into where I'm passionate about learning about psychology, social psychology, how all this works. And because at the end of the day, as an entrepreneur and as a CEO, you really think about most of what you're doing is you're dealing with people. And so from early on, it became important for us to have the right team. And I think sometimes you can either build the right team that you will grow into, and that becomes the driver for it. So that's my philosophy. So we go out and try to find the best people. But then also you have to build on that, right? So you want to...
So let's, you keep going, I want to talk about the best people. So day one, what does the team look like?
So day one, of course, the founders. And then...
And that's you and Jason. In this case, it was you and Jason. Yeah. And how do you differentiate your unique abilities? What did he do versus what
different
did you do?
Roles, yes. So, you know, he basically focused on product, clinical, obviously with his background, and innovation just around product and you know, things that we were building and dev and things like that. And I focused on basically overall team, fundraising, what we need to be successful, markets, clients, sort of the outside. We could say in some ways we played sort of the inside-outside role from the very beginning.
And that inside-outside role, very, very important. A lot of people don't realize that kind of the balance of the importance of the two of those.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, if you have both doing the same, that's, you know, you're not utilizing or maximizing, kind of not optimizing in the best way. So if you look at, so then we started looking at what the holds were. And in the beginning, you're strapped, right? So you want to look at, you know, what can you leverage to build up your Kia. So, you know, you hire a couple of people, you try to bring in advisors, you try to sort of leverage your network, what you have, and then you start to fill the holes. So quickly we realized, you know, where the holes were, and we tried to...
So day one, first five people, what were the other holes besides, so you and Jason are filled in inside-outside guy, what are the next three or four hires?
Yeah, then
like?
You have sort of, you know, the engineers, developers, whatever, you're building a platform, so you want to make sure that's neither of us, so that's kind of the first one.
And was that a CTO or just a senior developer?
No, like, senior developer. Started working with a couple of good developers, basically. So that was kind of the main thing. That was the biggest hole. Pretty much everything else you can, you know, I wore like the CFO hat and the controller hat and everything else. And we handled marketing and we kind of divvied up things that way. But then as you start to grow, then you just need people to handle, you know, basically the volume. Then it becomes about sort of delegating and giving basically, you know, roles and responsibilities and giving up some pieces of that.
So you went through kind of the early days and then kept, you know, you're talking about growing. How big are you today? How many people do you have today?
We have 60 people.
So you have 60 people and your leadership team. How many people have reported into you?
About seven.
Seven people. So talk a little bit about your leadership team.
So my leadership team, so Jason, of course, on the product clinical side. Then I have JC, who is seasoned operations guy, helped build a company from basically 50 people to 1,500 people with global operations. Anne, who I met at WebMD, she's our chief marketing officer, heads up sales and marketing for us. Seasoned background in healthcare and in marketing. I have Steve Chase, our CFO, worked with him before at MedSite. He was part of the team. And then we have HR and legal, and so Donna and Chris.
So you got a pretty complete team for the stage you're at now. How'd you find all of these amazing people? You mentioned WebMD is where you met one, but clearly you've done a terrific job of building this kind of dream team around you.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you go about it in a proactive way. You leverage your network. People you've worked with, of course, if you've worked with somebody before, it's great. They're sort of tried and tested. I would say everybody on our team is within one degree of separation at this point, which is hard to do when you're doing it for the first time. But Once you've done it a couple of times.
So I want to touch on one of the one degrees of separation, Jason, because you work with your first cousin.
Yes.
A little bit about, I work with a lot of my family members as well, and there are certain people that can do it and certain people that can't.
Yeah.
What's been some of the magic behind the way you've been, Jason, been able to not only build the company, but also balance that on the other side when you're with family?
You know, I would say one of the biggest things I would say is that you have to really, with us, it's three different hats we wear at any given time. We're family when we're family, and we try to avoid talking about work and other things. You're hanging out. Then we're founders.
Probably reminded by other family members that you're talking about work and you got to stop.
Spouses, usually, yes.
Happens with me too.
We focus on our role as founders, which is different than the role we play day-to-day. And we play day-to-day role, both founder and our kind of management role, but they are separate roles. As founders, we have certain responsibilities really around culture, developing the culture, making sure that we stay focused on our vision that we set out. And then as, you know, as management, we have different roles we play there. And there's a clear definition around those roles and responsibilities. So that, I think, and that's not just for me and Jason. I mean, that's true for everybody as we work, yes.
What do you think the biggest mistakes you made? So you've assembled this great team, and it looks like you've just done a spectacular job sequentially, right, building that team. But a little bit about, you know, what'd you learn, or what have been the mistakes you've made along the way that kind of got you to today, either at MedSite or at Medevo?
Yeah, I mean, specifically around people or generally?
Around people.
You know, I think generally one of the things that we can all do better at is not take too long to act on something. You know, that's basically one of the hardest things to do and get better at. But as we learn to become better leaders over time, that's something that, and that's true in everything. People sometimes, you know, you hire the wrong person. It's a wrong fit. So don't wait too long. Don't let that go.
Don't wait too long to
fire. Fix that. Yeah, if you have to, you know, and a lot of times you'll realize if you're feeling it, they're feeling it too. It's not, you know, it's hardly ever one-sided. And so course correct quickly. And that has to do with that. It also has to do with products. It has to do with partnerships. It has to do with, you know, one of the things that, earlier this year, we made a very tough decision, and it was around making a change. We changed our product strategy a little bit. It was really, we had two platforms that we were building as an early stage company, which was interesting because as I give advice to other early
entrepreneurs,
one of the things I always say is focus. Pick the one thing that you're going to do better than anybody else and do that. And put everything into it. And here we were, you know, towards the end of last year, realizing that we're really building like these two things, and they're two different businesses: data analytics and messaging and advertising. And we had to make a pretty tough decision to basically sunset the messaging advertising business. And it wasn't easy, especially because there were no external drivers or external factors that drove that change. It was really self-inflicted. We had to sit there and analyze and work through it, a lot of introspection. But we made a decision, which I think was the best decision we could have made, because already in the last 6 months, we're starting to see the fruits of that. So, you know, being more focused, we went from our patient database, which was at around, you know, 4.5 million at the end of last year, because of the messaging platform, the way we were gathering data, and we changed that, to work directly with the labs now. So in the last 7 months, we've gone from 4.5 to like almost 30 million patients.
So that multiple of growth, it was a direct result of the focus, which actually is a nice segue into one of the other drivers, which is being able to articulate a very clear vision, mm-hmm. Being able to be very clear with the goals of the organization, make sure that it's both an inspiring vision, but is well-defined. And it sounds like what you have said to other entrepreneurs, which we talk about all the time as well, which is focus, focus, focus.
Right.
You went from these two businesses to focusing on one, and have in the 8 months, you've had exponential growth of that. And did you shut that first one down? Did you stop working on it, or did you actually, you know, just slow it down and not add to it?
Yeah, so what we did was we came up with a plan. So I think that's another thing that you learn, you know, how to make better decisions over time. So I think when you're trying to make decisions in the immediate that have, and most decisions have a long-term impact. So you make a decision and it's around some immediate problem you're trying to fix. You're never going to make the best decision. So you try to think of it, and you try to think about making decisions in the long run. So we thought about, like, we said, let's think about our success. Let's picture us as a successful company in the next 2 to 3 years, and what does that look like? Now let's picture, you know, Metaverse as a failure and see what that looks like. And it became pretty evident. We said, if we don't get this right. So we really set a framework.
So who's we? I want to talk about you're having this discussion about the framework of your vision. Who's having this conversation?
It's my team. It's me and my team.
Leadership and, team and not your board yet.
Not your board, not our board yet. But, you know, we engaged them pretty early in the discussion as well. But we already knew what we wanted to do. So, you know, once we really started talking about it, it became pretty evident what we needed to do. So we created, and, you know, same thing I talked about the vision earlier. So you set out a vision, you think about what we want to achieve in the next 8 to 10 years. So we have that.
You know, and that hasn't changed from day one.
For us, it's really leveraging this big, large data set. So our long-term 8 to 10 year vision is to discover and enable ways to improve health by looking at the world's data.
Mm-hmm.
But in the next 3 to 5 years, we're really focused on lab data. So you create the framework of the 8 to 10 years, then you look at what you want to get done in the 3 to 5, and then you create your goals for near-term, quarterly, yearly goals. So that gives you perspective in your decision making. So same thing with the question you asked earlier around the business of advertising. We looked at it long term, and then we said, you know, of course we had client obligations, contracts we had signed. This was a sizable business for us.
The business actually had revenue and clients.
Absolutely.
And by the look of it from the outside, you'd say there's two great businesses here.
Yes.
But as the CEO and as the team, you said we need to focus even more if we want to achieve our both long-term and short-term
goals. And that's what made it harder, because, you know, you're saying no to revenues.
Yeah.
And clients that want it. And so basically we created a plan. So we said, you know, a year from now we want to look like this, and then work backwards to say, what do we want to get done in the next 6 months? Immediately we said, we'll stop selling it. So we did that. Then we had, you know, contracts that we of course want to live by our obligations, and we fulfilled on those. So we put our 110% effort in all that and delivered on that. And that's now sort of sunsetting out.
So I've always admired your clarity around your goals. I know you carry your goals and your strategic plan in your back pocket. It's a one-page plan. It has not just your vision and your core values, but it has your specific metrics that you're going to look at. And you pull it out, you know, without even thinking twice about it, to not only review it with yourself, but with others. Can you just talk a little bit about the importance of the written down goals and the clarity that you now have as a result of being able to carry it around in your pocket and have it emanate from there?
Yeah. So, you know, I think if you think about as an entrepreneur or a CEO, of course, those are your goals. That's what you're setting out to accomplish. So it helps to have that thought through and written down, so there's some clarity around that. But more than that, you realize as you start to grow as a company and you're more than just a few people, and then you've got a few dozen people, 50 plus people, and then thousands, and, you know, obviously hundreds of thousands of people in a company. So you want to have, in really, I realized this more actually after I sold MedSight, because I had a different role then. So I didn't have the same visibility that I had in companies' decision making and other things, even though I was part of the management team at WebMD, but it was different. So I realized the importance of having that, especially on that one page format, that can easily be shared with anybody. You know, now it's actually, what we're doing now is even interesting. So we still have that one pager, and that's kind of where it all starts. But we started using a tool. We use 7geese,
basically. Isn't that a great tool? Yeah. We use that tool. In fact, you referred that to us, and a lot of the entrepreneurs in the program use it as well. It's a great tool.
So, you know, we put our objectives and key results in there. And I always tell people in the company, if you want to know what we're doing, and anybody, if anybody wants to know what anybody's working on, 24/7, you have clear visibility, transparency, until you can go in there and see what's going on. So I think around really motivating people, driving people, and getting everybody on the same page, it's one of the things that I found to be really useful.
So 7geese focuses, for those who haven't used it before, it's a great tool for objectives and key results, something that everybody from Google to Intel and lots of companies have been using religiously in paper format or spreadsheet format, but have made it really easy to define your key objectives, objectives and key results from the top down. It cascades and connects in together. Yep. How often do you guys use that as a catalyst for planning and then go back to sharing?
So we basically, so once a year we do our 5-year plan. So we revise it every summer. And then based on the 5-year plan, we come up with kind of the yearly plan. And then every quarter, we revise it for the next quarter. And then usage-wise, you know, every week I have my one-on-ones with my team and we look at the objectives and key results and we talk about challenges around that. We talk about what's going well, not going well. So that's something we do on a weekly basis.
And does the team also do all their check-ins on there? Like,
absolutely.
We use it so that everybody every Friday puts in their actual results from the week. So you use it
the same way. It sort of, you know, more real time, but definitely within a week it's refreshed. So you can see on a weekly basis the changes that are happening. And you can see, as you know, you use the tool, you can see kind of percentage-wise where we are with those goals.
I know, so, it's great. It's like, it's definitely a great platform, not only for my own anxiety as CEO, but you have it as a great way of connecting everybody together, the same thing, and having them see how their goals connect to the larger corporate objectives and organizational goals.
And the corporate objectives, you know, that's what we share with our board. So it's really directly tied. So people can see how what I'm working on at any level in the company is tied directly to the overall goal.
Fantastic. So I want to take that and, you know, talked about your boards. I want to transition a little bit to boards. Another driver is the ability to get great support and access to great advisors. You have a very unique approach, very forward-thinking approach to building advisory boards. Most people, if they're lucky, start to talk about they want to build an advisory board early in the company. You haven't just thought about it. You've done it and have a very unique way of viewing the need for advisory boards, not just for yourself, but for people in your organizations or projects. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think advisory boards can be really powerful, powerful tools for companies, especially early stage, to grow. And I think at any level, and it just depends on who's on your advisory board. As we go from really early stage to growth stage, and you know, you have different types of people involved. So for us, we set up an advisory board very early. I was very lucky to be able to attract some amazing people to our advisory board. So on our advisory board today, we have people like Esther Dyson, we have Vita Cassess, ex-CIO of Pfizer, we have Alan Sokolow, he was the chief medical officer of Oxford Health. So we have some amazing,
I got to step back because you just rattled off really wonderful names. How'd you bring them to become part of your advisory board? And is that your advisory board for as CEO of the company?
Yeah. So I looked at, again, same as, you know, looking at the team to look at where the holes are. So we looked at where can I add additional dimensions to my team, right? So when I think about myself and my strengths and weaknesses, I look at the team. And overall, you know, advisors are people that are seasoned. They have a lot of experience in their area of expertise. And for me, it's great to be able to bounce ideas off of them and get their perspective on things. That's what I value the most. I value, you know, their perspective. And that's exactly why they're there. So for us on our advisory board, it's a mix of people that have, you know, health and tech experience, let's say, a different experience with someone like Esther, or pharma or payer experience or physician experience. data analytics experience. So we look at that, and then as we are setting our goals, as challenges come up, we can share those with the board and get their advice on.
And so I want to differentiate between advisory board and board of directors. Yes. Because they're very different.
Totally different. Different
things. So on your board of directors are your investors and Jason and
yeah. So board? On the board of directors, it's the two founders. It's two investors. So Joe Volpe from Merck's Global Health Innovation mm-hmm. Fund and Gary Kurtzman from Safeguard. And then we have Dave Stack, who's phenomenal. He's basically a executive pharma at Roche, but in the last like 15, 20 years, he's taken three or four specialty pharma companies public. He's just had a huge success again with Pacira. So it's someone that, you know, has a lot of operations experience and is also a CEO, and he's taken, you know, companies from nothing to $1 billion. So it's great to have someone like that on the board to not only get advice on the industry, but also on, as a CEO, you know, things that can help guide me to
So grow, how grow often does your board of directors meet?
Quarterly.
And what about your board of advisors, and how do you kind of think about leveraging your board of advisors and yeah. the difference between them?
Yeah, so the board of directors, I mean, they have fiduciary responsibilities sure. to shareholders. It's a very more formal role. And board of advisors, there are a lot of informal discussions that take place on a one-off basis, and depending on, you know, where the advisor is in their life, in their career, some have more time, some have less time. But what we try to do is we do a monthly, a quick monthly one-hour advisory board call, where we're going to prepare a presentation beforehand. We will highlight a couple of issues. We send that ahead of time.
Is everybody on the advisory board invited to everyone, or do you pick and choose
yes,
certain advisors?
They're all yes, they're all invited to everyone because it creates a great dialogue.
Sure.
You get different perspectives from a pair to
pharma. So that's all conference call, and they're all invited, and you do an agenda. How many people are on your advisory board?
Like five or six.
Okay. Yep. So you've got your advisory board. Tell yep. me a little bit about your view of advisory boards for other people in your organization or even projects. We talked about the idea sure. of short-term advisory boards too.
Yeah, again, very powerful. So we also have a medical advisory board that Jason runs, and these are physicians. It's all clinically focused, and he runs that. And I think people have seen in the company how powerful they can be. So recently, we had a big project going on around next generation of our data infrastructure on the back end. And so we formed a advisory board just for the project. So one of our advisors from our corporate advisory board is a member of the project advisory board, but there are also a couple of others that are just there for helping guide the project. And they bring a certain expertise to the table. And again,
and they know they're on just for the project.
They're on just, and their responsibility is not to deliver on the project.
Right.
It's really just to advise.
Sure. And how are you compensating everybody? So you've got your, obviously, putting your board of directors aside, how are you compensating your advisors?
Yeah, it's a combination of, it's mostly options. So they have some upside in it in the long run. And then depending on if they're really putting in hours, if they're putting in days of work, if they want to get involved a lot more, then we also set up a consulting agreement with them as well.
So you could end up having them as a consultant as well.
Yes.
One of the things Esther's also on our advisory board, and one of the things I always admired was that she was always clear with, tell me what I can do to help you. So
yes.
She's actually asked for an assignment mm-hmm. and has been very helpful, by the way, in following through with that. And Jerry Levin, our chairman of Startup Health, came from one of the requests we put into Esther to kind of connect us with a billion-dollar board member,
yeah.
An advisor, and ultimate investor, which has been fantastic. Have you assigned any responsibility outside the monthly call or the project? Have you had any, you know, ability to kind of give them an assignment and actually have them come back and deliver on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, lots of little ones, almost like on an ongoing basis. And it depends. It could be something from just getting introductions to getting feedback on a pricing model we're thinking about. And I think, yeah, like anything else, you have to be specific. You know, everybody's busy. We're all running around. And so if they're going to commit to be on your advisory board, then it's really your responsibility to make sure that you're getting what you need out of them. And also, that's how they feel productive too. If there's nothing going on, you know, they're not going to be engaged.
Have you had advisors that didn't work out? And have you had anybody that you kind of either didn't renew or you didn't keep them involved that you originally thought was going to be a great advisor?
Yeah, I would say, you know, one of our best advisors, we've had great ones. And Lydia Fonseca, who is now the CIO of Quest Diagnostics, she was the CIO of LabCorp and actually left there to spend time with her family, things like that. But during that transition, I approached her and she was very happy to be involved and spent a year with us. And when she took on the other role, you know, we work with a lot of labs, so it would have been a conflict of interest. So because of that, she had to step down. But it was a great, I mean, we got a lot out of it. And I think when I talked to her, you know, she really enjoyed that role as well. So, yeah, I mean, there have been times where depending on what the advisor is going to do next or is doing, it may not work out, but we haven't had any, I don't think we've had any that just didn't work out. We said, why did we do
this? So I think, and we're last piece on advisors, because I want to move on to a couple of other things that you do really uniquely well around funding. Specifically, you have a view of how or when best to engage advisors in terms of their own careers even. Sometimes I know you look at people who've recently left positions or have been out of the market for a little bit, maybe in transition or retired. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been able to tap into some of the smartest people on the planet that way? Because I think that's really unique.
What I realized was early on that if you approach people during a time of transition, it's when they're very open to ideas. It's actually you're helping them too, because part of what they're doing, if they're in between things, they're trying to explore and see what else is out there. So you're providing a lot of value back to an advisor in that. And I think back at my own career, you know, when I transitioned out of WebMD and I was, before I did something else, I was excited to learn about what else was going on out there. Especially when I was coming back from Brazil, I had been sort of out for more than a year. So I would have talked to any
staff. Right. You
know, I was like, more, yeah, give me more. I want to know what's going on. So I think if you approach people then, and also they have time. They have a lot more time and you can really get to know people better when they have time to spend with you. And because when everybody has their day job, everybody's busy. So it's just, it makes sense. So it's worked out pretty well for us.
And obviously very well. One of the last drivers I want to touch on with you is it's so important to have enough capital to execute on your vision. Mm-hmm. And both at MedSite and now at Medivo, you've raised adequate amounts of financing, kind of even from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Your initial financing before you even did your A round with Safeguard, then a round you did with Safeguard, and then more recently with Merck and Safeguard for your last round. Talk a little bit about both how much you've raised, but also philosophically, I know you believe that, you know, while you can operate lean and efficient, which I believe you do, you still kind of balance that with having enough cash to go execute and have enough runway to execute on the vision.
Yeah, so definitely. I think especially in healthcare, you need to make sure that you've raised enough money to be able to really execute on what your plans are. Healthcare is a difficult industry, as we know, and depends on also what you're doing within healthcare. It's very different than, you know, launching one app, which, you know, a million people will start using overnight and you can sell it for $1 billion.
Or multi-billion dollars.
Multi-billion dollars. I think it's, you're dealing with a lot of organizations that are siloed. You're dealing with regulations where you need to have certain certifications. You need to have, you know, for us with HIPAA, we need to be HIPAA compliant. We need to get audited. So these are things that just cost money. And if you want to compete with the big boys, you need to be able to have that kind of infrastructure and you need to be able to compete with them head to head. So you need to think about all that and think about what you need to raise to be able to do it. I don't believe that how much money a company raises is sort of a variable of success for that company. It's really, you know, the value that you're building. So if you're thinking about, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, the long-term vision, long-term value, if you're really focused on that, then you can't really have the money be a factor that drives you. Again, that becomes sort of a short-term issue that will drive decision-making that has long-term impact. Now, you know, someone like Google that's generating billions of dollars, I mean, they can do their moonshots and they can do all that, but startups can't exactly do that. So you want to be able to, you want to have adequate financing to be able to do all the things that you need to do to be successful.
So what was that adequate financing day one for you, for phase one of launching Medavail?
Yeah, so in the beginning, you know, we started with our own money. That was sort of the very beginning, and we were lucky enough to be able to do that. And so that gave us, we were lean, that gave us some time to think about exactly what we wanted to do. And we brought in some angel investors. So we did around, you know, $600,000-$700,000 in an angel round. That was year one. And then we, you know, at that point, we already had revenues. We had thought through kind of what the value prop is. We built the product, the platform. And at that point, we were ready to raise real money.
You articulated those, as you packaged up this first phase, you outlined all the different milestones you achieved with the money you had raised before you went on to do that proper A round.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we said we had certain milestones that we wanted to hit. We wanted to have revenue. We wanted to go out there as an early growth stage company, not just as a startup raising our Series A. Which we were able to do. So we, you know, so Safeguard invested at that point in as a early growth stage company.
And that was
our Series A.
And how much did you raise?
About seven.
So back when you raised it, it was probably 2011.
So towards the end of
that was for in healthcare. That was a larger A round. Now we're seeing them. I think there's a $21 million A round last week or 2 weeks ago. Right. Talk a little. $7 million. Mm-hmm. Was that amount the amount you needed to achieve a certain number of milestones? How, you know, was that more or less than you originally wanted to raise?
Yeah, I know it was. It was around what we wanted to raise. I think we could have raised more. I mean, just there was interest in. in putting in more from other investors, but we wanted to raise enough, and I thought about sort of, you know, based on what our plans were at that time, how much value can we create, and does that make sense for the investor, for us, and everybody else? So that felt like a good number, and so we went with that. And then as things progressed, we looked at, you know, additional opportunities. And of course, you know, on day one, you don't know all the stuff that's going to happen. I mean, nobody does. And so you kind of work through your next set of milestones. As we did that, we saw some big opportunities, especially around aggregating all this lab data, which is there's 6,000 labs out there. So if you want to have 30, 40, 50% of all this data, it's a pretty expensive endeavor. So we thought about, you know, what do we need next to go out and do that. So we raised about $15 million in our Series B round. And with that...
And who participated? That was
so
Merck?
So that was led by Merck's Global Health Innovation Fund, and Safeguard participated more than their pro rata. And that, basically, we raised that money to get us to profitability. So that's the plan. Now, you know, I get asked sometimes, are we going to raise more? Are we going to do a Series C? You know, I think that all depends on, and we were having this discussion also with our board, depends on what sort of the next set of goals and objectives that we want to go after, new markets, beyond kind of our current plan. What else can we do to accelerate beyond that? And only then would it make sense to go out and raise more money.
So if you think about those three phases, kind of your seed round, A round, B round, you know, angel investors and your own money in the first round, a traditional VC in the second round, and then a strategic kind of venture arm in the third. Clearly, the first part was based on your track record, right? Mm-hmm. What do you think, you know, I know you had choices when you did your A round, because it was right around when you were entering Startup Health. Mm-hmm. You had your choices of different options for VCs. You really were thoughtful about which VCs you not only went to, but then even were willing to take over the finish line. And then you were very thoughtful about your third, you know, your B round. How did you think about, what made it your choice versus begging for money? What do you think it was about Medavo and what you were selling or pitching or presenting to them that made the biggest difference?
I think it was, I mean, obviously it definitely helps if you've done it before, right? If you've built a company in the space and you've sold it, that goes a long way. You have some credibility to start with. I mean, it's not going to get you through the finish line.
Sure.
But, you know, and then again, it depends on, you know, all the same things that you guys talk about, right? You know, it's like, is the opportunity big enough? What are the big shifts that are happening? What makes you unique? I mean, all those things. So I think if you really think about it, if you're, you know, for us, it was really, yes, there was some credibility there to start with. That definitely helped us with the A round. And then also the goals that you set. So Safeguard invested in our A round. They more than, you know, fully participated in the B round. And I think it's that's based on, you know, the results that we were achieving.
So and you were clear and you were clear black and white with your goals, which I point out to entrepreneurs all the time, because oftentimes they're loosey, you know, they're loose or ambiguous goals. You were very clear. I remember looking at your deck for your round with Safeguard, and it was black and white. You had a list of all the milestones you achieved, and then you had a list of all the things you wanted to achieve with their money.
And I think that sometimes we confuse, you know, there is ambiguity. There always will be. But I think sometimes, you know, even for me, if I look back at earlier in my career, it's still more important to have those things written out. And it's okay for them to change. And that's the piece that I think people have to sort of realize and be okay with, because it's worse to not write them down because you think they may change. But if you have them, and if they change, it's okay for them to change. So I think if you go with that, I mean, you know, we are not, you know, some things have gone better than planned, some things have gone worse than planned, and some things we've completely changed, as I talked about earlier in the year. But we updated our plan that quarter, changed it, and it's, again, clear to everybody. And so you have a game plan that you're working off of, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, I could talk about this with you for hours.
Yes.
Last thing, I want to come full circle. So you and I met as part of YPO, Young Presidents Organization. And for YPO for me, introduced me to the value of peer networks, getting support from other entrepreneurs that not only have your back, but can kind of help you figure out what works, what doesn't work. And a lot of that we built into Startup Health, obviously, a peer network of just entrepreneurs in the healthcare space. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit for just a few moments about your view of the importance of peer networks and being a part of a peer network as you build your business, not just to connect with others, but to get supported by, and the value of a support network like entrepreneurs like you around you?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's extremely powerful, because if you can share your challenges, you can share your stories, you can share with others that are sharing theirs, then all of a sudden you can learn. I mean, it goes back to learning. I mean, we talked about advisors, we talked about, you know, studying. I mean, you go to Coursera, you can take any course. I mean, there's so many things you can do, but this is one where you're learning from people's experiences. And I think that's one of the most powerful things, because you can go have a quick, you know how it is. We go to, it could be like an event. We're at an event, it's a social event, but you have something in your, you know, on your mind, and it's not something, I mean, and a lot of those things, what I found with the YPO especially is that I'm able to talk to people about things that I normally can't really talk to my board about or advisors. It's some things that are unique that I feel more comfortable sharing, because, you know, it's a forum where there's confidentiality, of course, and it's a respected group of peers that have experience, that are successful and have been through sort of similar things as you. So it's very easy to get like candid feedback, which is really powerful. I mean, other than networking and getting, you know, connected to people you may need to connect to and stuff, this aspect of it, where you can get advice from others that have gone through similar things, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, no, and you give back as much as you take from those. It seems you've, especially in Startup Health, you've been able to, you know, the beauty of a peer network where you've got people at all stages is you've got some people that have closed A rounds or B rounds, and those that have not. You've had people that have sold companies and those that have not, but everybody feeding off each other, and you've been very generous with kind of your participation in that. So I appreciate that. I know a lot of the other healthcare transformers do as well. I could do five episodes with you, really, on so many different aspects of this, from really the framework of being bold enough and courageous enough to be a serial healthcare entrepreneur. Lots of serial entrepreneurs out there, but serial healthcare entrepreneurs in abundance, there are not. So you've done that. You've done a great job of building a team, a fundable, backable team that I think you had and really shared some really special things around not only doing it, but doing it with family, which I think is a really, you know, unique thing. I love your uniqueness around how you think about advisory boards. I think if there's one thing that we see entrepreneurs not doing enough of is leaning on the expertise of other people. Mm-hmm. And so you've done such a spectacular job on that. And I also love, a lot of people think that you got checks written because of your past success, but you're executing with Medevo. You're doing very focused job, clearly, on achieving things that you set out to and adjusting along the way. I think this year's pivot is quite interesting and a great example of, you know, even serial entrepreneurs, even great teams start to realize that you get splintered in your focus. So I think you've done a great job on that. So we're definitely going to have you back for more episodes.
Okay, thanks, Steve. I really enjoyed it. This is fun. I think it's great what you guys are doing. I love the ecosystem you're building. I think both from, and as companies start to mature, and you guys have how many now?
It'll be 80 companies.
80 companies. I mean, it's phenomenal. I remember when you talked to me about it early days, about what you were going to do and how it's going to happen. And it's great to see that it's happening. And I think the ecosystem will only get more and more powerful as you have more companies in it, and you've done an amazing job in bringing in all these people around it, which I think is phenomenal.
Well, we started with the Great Foundation with you in the first the first group, so
yes,
it's my pleasure. And I want to thank everybody for listening, downloading, and subscribing to Startup Health Now. We're definitely going to have Sandeep Bond back. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of requests for that as well. And once again, I just want to thank you so much for spending your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.